It was probably the most ignominious entry into Washington ever made by a new president. The Pinkerton Detective Agency had warned of an assassination plot, so Abraham Lincoln slipped through Baltimore and into the US Capitol at dead of night, disguised as an invalid passenger and using a special train. The United States was on the brink of civil war, North against South. It was Thomas Jefferson, one of America's founding fathers, who predicted that the country would be a great empire of liberty. Empire it had indeed become, expanding from the Atlantic to the Pacific through intrepid settlers, but also by war against Mexico and by evicting the Indians from their homelands. Liberty, too, was America's hallmark. Millions had flooded across the Atlantic and over the continent to farm their own land and win religious freedom. Yet the economy of the South was built on the labour of slaves. And as Southerners moved west, they took slavery with them. Lincoln had warned that the United States could not survive half slave and half free. The victory in 1860 of his Republican Party drove seven states in the Deep South to declare independence and secede from the Union, convinced that Lincoln was bent on abolishing slavery. Modelling themselves on the original Declaration of Independence in 1776, they created their own independent government, the Confederate States of America, known as the Confederacy. Lincoln wanted to stop slavery expanding into the West, but he was no abolitionist and made that clear in his inaugural address as president on March the 4th, 1861.
I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so.
The new president's aim was to hold the United States together. He hoped that Southern supporters of the Union would restrain their hotheads. It was to these moderates that Lincoln reached out at the end of his speech.
There will be no invasion. We are not enemies, but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature.
Moving words, but they came too late. Lincoln had made clear that, although he would not invade the South, he would not allow the property of the federal government to be seized. Crunch point in the spring of 1861 was Fort Sumter, in Charleston Harbor, in the heartland of the new Confederacy. Northern opinion had turned its commander, Major Robert Anderson, into a patriotic symbol of Union resistance. Anderson was a former slave owner from Kentucky, who sympathized with the Southern cause. But as a regular army officer, his loyalties remained ultimately with the Union. Across the water in Charleston, his opponent was General Pierre Beauregard of Louisiana. Years earlier, Beauregard had made his name at West Point Military Academy as a superb artillery officer. His instructor was Robert Anderson. Here was a foretaste of the ruptures, ironic and often tragic, that accompanied civil war. In the city of Charleston, Mary Chestnut, wife of a leading Confederate, noted in her diary,
"Yesterday's was the merriest, maddest dinner we have yet had. Men were audaciously wise and witty. We had an unspoken foreboding that it was to be our last pleasant meeting. I did not pretend to go to sleep. How can I? If Anderson does not accept terms at four, the orders are he shall be fired upon. I count four. St. Michael's bells chime out, and I begin to hope. At 4:30, the heavy booming of a cannon. I sprang out of bed, and on my knees prostrate, I prayed as I never prayed before."
Under orders from the Confederacy, Beauregard opened fire on the morning of April the 12th, 1861. Citizens of Charleston watched from their rooftops as hundreds of shells flamed and crashed over the fort. Meanwhile, daily life went on as usual. Mary Chestnut noted,
"Not by one word or look can we detect any change in the demeanor of our Negro servants. You could not tell that they even heard the awful roar going on in the bay. Are they stolidly stupid, or wiser than we are, silent and strong, biding their time?"
Anderson, starved of supplies and shells, held out for a day and a half, but then surrendered. Fort Sumter was also the tipping point for states in the Upper South. 5 days later, Virginia voted for secession. The most populous state in the South, with almost as much industrial capacity as the original seven Confederate states put together, it would be vital to a successful war effort. And so would Robert E. Lee. By common consent, Lee was the most promising senior officer in the U.S. Army. He was a West Pointer who'd served in the Mexican War of the 1840s. And after Fort Sumter surrendered, Lincoln offered him field command of the Union Army. But Lee was a Virginian. His hilltop mansion at Arlington looked out across the Potomac River to the city of Washington. After Virginia voted to secede, Lee spent an anguished night in his study. But in the end, he put state before country, informing his sister,
"With all my devotion to the Union and the feeling of loyalty and duty of an American citizen, I have not been able to make up my mind to raise my hand against my relatives, my children, my home. I have therefore resigned my commission in the Army."
Next day, Lee rode south to Richmond, the new Confederate capital, where he was offered command of the Army of Virginia. He would never visit his home again. Actually, there was no point. Vengeful Northerners turned his front lawn into Arlington National Cemetery, hallowed ground for the Union dead. On both sides, men now flocked to the colours. Lincoln had called up the troops for 90 days. This was actually for legal reasons, but it seemed to sum up the general expectations of a quick war. Southerners believed the Northerners were too soft to fight. Northerners were convinced that the Confederacy would crumble as soon as force was applied. Most great wars begin with short war illusions. Elisha Rhodes, a 19-year-old office boy in Providence, Rhode Island, was desperate to enlist. His widowed mother insisted that he was her only means of support. But such was Rhodes' disappointment that
Sunday night, after I had retired, my mother came to my room and, with a spirit worthy of a Spartan mother of old, said, "My son, other mothers must make sacrifices, and why should not I? If you feel it is your duty to enlist, I will give my consent."
Rhodes and many of his friends joined the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers. 2 months later, he got his first sight of the nation's capital.
"We are in Washington, and what a city! As we passed the White House, I had my first view of Abraham Lincoln. He looks like a good, honest man, and I trust that with God's help, he can bring our country safely out of its peril."
In the South, the mood was very similar. Sam Watkins was 21 when he joined the 1st Tennessee Regiment. After some basic training, his unit was loaded into boxcars in this, the first railway war.
"Leaving Nashville, we went bowling 20 or 30 miles an hour, as fast as steam could carry us. At every town and station, citizens and ladies were waving their handkerchiefs and hurrahing for the Southern Confederacy. Magnificent banquets were prepared for us all along the entire route."
The boys from Tennessee were being rushed northeast to Virginia. The rival capitals were only about 100 miles apart, and in mid-July 1861, the Union Army marched out of Washington en route for Richmond. Well warned, the Confederate forces under Beauregard moved north to meet them, and the two armies faced off along Bull Run Creek. This was only 25 miles from Washington, and hundreds of civilians came out from the city, equipped with binoculars and picnic baskets, to watch the entertainment. Most of the soldiers had never been in battle before. Individuals fought bravely, but the Union forces gradually lost cohesion, while Southern reinforcements poured in from the nearby railroad junction at Manassas. The Southerners surged forward, unleashing a chilling half-shout, half-yelp that became known as the Rebel Yell. The exhausted Northerners, many of them 90-day men whose term was almost up, decided they'd had enough. It has been well said that inside every army there's a crowd struggling to get out. And this Northern army was only semi-trained. Retreat soon turned into a rout. Abandoned civilian carriages clogged the roads and bridges, and many soldiers were drowned trying to cross the Bull Run Creek. One of the crowd was Elisha Rhodes.
Of the horrors of that night, I can give you no adequate idea. I suffered untold horrors from thirst and fatigue, but struggled on, clinging to my gun and cartridge box. Many times I sat down in the mud, determined to go no further, and willing to die to end my misery. But soon a friend would pass and urge me to make another effort, and I would stagger on a mile further. At daylight, we could see the spires of Washington, and what a welcome sight it was.
William Howard Russell, war correspondent for the Times of London, asleep in his Washington hotel, was awakened by the noise. He saw
a steady stream of men covered in mud, soaked through with rain, who were pouring irregularly, without any semblance of order, up Pennsylvania Avenue towards the Capitol. A dense stream of vapor rose from the multitude. Many of them were without knapsacks, crossbelts, and firelocks. Some had neither greatcoats nor shoes. Others were covered in blankets.
A pale, exhausted young officer told Russell they'd been pretty well whipped in Virginia. On the Confederate side, Sam Watkins and his trainload of buddies from Tennessee reached Manassas Station a few hours after the battle had finished. They couldn't believe their bad luck.
We felt that the war was over, and we would have to return home without even seeing a Yankee soldier. How we envied those who were wounded. We thought at the time we would have given $1,000 to have been in that battle, and to have our arms shot off so we could have returned home with an empty sleeve.
Watkins needn't have worried. The war wasn't over. In fact, it had hardly begun. Shocked by the shambles, Lincoln called for another 100,000 troops, this time for 3 years, not 3 months. After the Battle of Bull Run, or Manassas as Confederates called it, both North and South recognized that the war would not be over quickly. But neither side had any inkling of the horrors still to come.